Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter and Katie Weaver. Later, Alice Bryant and Phil Dierking will have this week's education report. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
World oil prices have risen a little after 2 years of weaker demand for oil and lower prices. During that time, a number of developments have affected the balance between oil supplies and demand. One is unrest in some oil-producing countries. Another is the expanded use of technology for collecting oil from deep underground. In addition, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries has been working on a deal to reduce oil production. OPEC's members have been trying to limit production to ease oversupply. Perhaps the easiest way for Americans to experience the effects of oil prices is through gasoline. American drivers have paid less for fuel as oil supplies have increased and prices have dropped. In the United States, oil production has increased sharply in recent years. One reason is new technology, such as hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking. It has helped drilling services recover more oil and natural gas from the earth. In fracking, liquid is forced into the ground under high pressure. The force can break up rock under the earth's surface, releasing oil and gas. Hannah Brule is with the U.S. Energy Information Administration. She thinks oil prices will rise as supplies or inventories of unsold oil start to decrease.
Global supply has far exceeded global consumption, so we've seen massive inventory builds, and we've seen lower prices as a result. But once the supply and consumption come back into alignment and the inventories level off and even start to be drawn down, that'll be a market signal to increase production.
Low oil prices hurt companies that use fracking, making their operations too costly and less profitable. Rising prices, says Brule, make it more cost-effective for oil producers to keep shale wells operating. She says demand for oil is expected to rise over a long period of time. Other things can influence oil prices. Members of OPEC and some major non-OPEC producers, like Russia, appear to have agreed on a deal to limit production. Russia's energy minister, Alexander Novak, says the two sides are trying to make joint agreements. Reports of a deal helped push oil prices above $50 a barrel temporarily. Prices had fallen to less than $40 last year. As a cartel, OPEC's members seek to fix prices so they can increase profits. One way they do this is with limits on oil production. The group is expected to meet in late November to finalize details of a production agreement. Several members including Iraq, have asked for permission to be exempt from cuts. About two-thirds of electricity in the United States comes from coal and natural gas. The U.S. Energy Information Administration says oil has little direct effect on the cost of energy. It says that only 1% of the country's electricity comes from oil. The cost of producing renewable energy has continued to fall. The International Energy Agency says renewable has become the world's largest new source of energy. The cost of producing energy from sources like the sun and wind is also decreasing. I'm Mario Ritter.
A program designed to help families escape poverty in the American state of Georgia is serving as a model for other parts of the United States. The program is a partnership between private donors and the city government in Atlanta, Georgia's capital. Today, the East Lake neighborhood of Atlanta is a nice place to live. But 20 years ago, the neighborhood was unsafe and looked unappealing. Recently, VOA reporter Chris Simpkins visited East Lake and spoke with Daniel Choi, the president of the East Lake Foundation. The foundation was set up to help people in the community.
More than 20 years ago, this was the home to East Lake Meadows, which was one of the nation's most violent housing developments, and today is probably one of the most promising.
The city and private charities are spending $150 million to help poor families escape poverty. Carol Naughton works for a nonprofit group called Purpose Built Communities. It works with local leaders to help improve communities.
The absolute idea of income inequality is part of the problem, but the lack of social mobility is just as big a problem. If people in America don't feel like they have a reasonable shot at working and earning a better life and creating a better opportunity for their children, I think our democracy is threatened at its very core.
East Lake Village is home to about 2,100 people. Only low or middle income individuals are permitted to live there. The housing development has banks, a grocery store, and other businesses usually found in higher income neighborhoods. Young people in East Lake are given help with their education so they can go to college and get a good job. 20 years ago, an average family of four in this neighborhood struggled to earn $4,500 a year. Choi says the average income in East Lake is now about $20,000.
There was only 14% employment in this community, and now we see 100% employment for the families that we work with who are living in the subsidized units. We've seen a dramatic increase in annual household income.
Michelle Campbell and her family have experienced success since they moved to East Lake in 2013. Campbell helps operate the housing development. She is building wealth and will soon buy her first home.
This type of program encouraged self-sufficiency. It's a move to work program. So the residents are required to work 30 hours or more in order to be on the program. And the goal is geared to them getting off the program, finding a home, getting into a better position financially.
East Lake leaders say its success can be a model for what is possible when people come together to end poverty. I'm Katie Weaver.
In August, a group of eighth grade girls took part in an unusual protest in the American state of Maryland. The girls are students at Urbana Middle School in Frederick County, Maryland. When they walked into Urbana's dining room in yellow baggy t-shirts, everyone cheered. The top school official required the group to wear the t-shirts after violating Urbana's dress code. But the girls added large lettering to their clothing. It read, "I am more than a distraction." The t-shirt punishment is not written in Urbana's dress code. The school official made it up. That is one reason why the girls carried out their protest. The girls are part of a larger group of students in Frederick County who believe dress codes unfairly target girls. Also in Maryland, a young woman named Rachel Zuniga launched what became a popular student petition at Linganore High School. Her campaign questioned why many of Linganore's dress code policies required girls to cover up too much of their bodies. School administrators say student opposition to dress codes is normal for the first month or two of every school year. Yet, the last few years have witnessed something different. A growing number of American girls expressing the belief that those policies unfairly target them. The United States Supreme Court ruled in 1969 that schools have the right to limit a student's expression if they believe that it disturbs the learning environment or violates the rights of other students. But there are often conflicts between what the school officials believe is a disturbance and what the students believe are their rights in a democracy. Many students think that dress codes conflict with the policy of gender equality, an important idea in American democracy.
2 years ago, a group of girls in South Orange, New Jersey, launched an online campaign to protest their high school's dress code. The campaign was called #IAmMoreThanADistraction. It received attention nationwide from girls who shared their experiences about what they believed were unfair rules on students' clothing. Since that campaign began, hundreds of petitions have questioned school dress codes, and some students have walked out of school in protest, notes The Atlantic. Many girls are uniting under their opposition to dress codes. They say these rules result in body shaming. The girls also say the codes excuse rape culture and support unhealthy ways of thinking about women that can lead to sexual assault. At the heart of it all, they say, is the belief that girls' bodies are a distraction. Lauren Weiss is the director of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at American University in Washington, D.C. She agrees that some dress codes target girls. Other educators and sociologists also find dress codes rooted in a highly problematic societal logic that girls and women are the ones who need to protect themselves from unwanted attention, says The Atlantic, and that those wearing what could be considered sexy clothing are asking for a response. Lauren Weiss believes a new social awareness is happening among girls, and that some of it is the result of the popularity of what we might call pop culture feminism, she told VOA. She said celebrities like Beyoncé, Taylor Swift, and Emma Watson have publicly promoted feminist ideas in ways that seem to make sense to young women. Media personalities may be partly responsible for this new recognition among girls, but social media is also adding to the national discussion. Last year, security officers at Vista Murrieta High School in California removed at least 25 girls from class for dress code violations, according to 17 magazine. Most of the girls were told their dresses or skirts were too short. The incident took place on a day in June when the temperature was about 32 degrees Celsius. The school's policy says that dresses, skirts, and shorts must be no shorter than 10 centimeters above the top of the knee. Some Vista Murrieta girls posted images on social media to show their clothing the day they were dress coded and to show their school's clothing policy. Vista Murrieta High School's policy includes one list for boys and another list for girls. Some of the policies for clothing length, for example, only apply to girls. One student posted a photograph on social media of a boy wearing very short shorts, noting that girls are not permitted to wear shorts that length.
Weiss believes that the Vista Murrieta students and others are evidence of something beyond gender, a larger social movement around inequality. Social media has helped young people reach a wider audience. Girls at Linganore, for example, use Twitter for this goal. They started an account called @LinganoreGirls to support each other and work against misogyny and body shaming. At Farragut High School in Knoxville, Tennessee, student Holly Sykes started a petition on change.org, a social media site for launching national petitions. Her appeal read, "Are we as a county seriously willing to send a girl home and deprive her of her education simply because her shorts are too short?" She also wrote that these rules promote victim blaming. More than 3,700 people have signed her petition.
A spokesperson for Knox County Schools told WATE.com that parents and students did not object to the dress code after a public school board meeting on those rules. Even so, some parents do object to school dress codes and are using social media to discuss their experiences. A mother in Kansas, Kimberly Jones, became angry after her daughter was forced to change into gym clothing at school. She posted a photo of her 11-year-old daughter's violation, a long shirt with leggings. The girl was new to the school, Jones explained to People magazine. Jones used Facebook to tell her story. She wrote that the school did not allow her daughter to call her to bring her a different pair of pants. Apparently, 13-year-old boys can't control themselves around this, she said jokingly about her daughter's long shirt and leggings.
Weiss calls the growing social movement around dress code a positive and hopeful sign that young people today will be active in civic life in a way that has not happened in many years. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Phil Dierking.
Today we have another report about a famous American. This person became famous for her ability to shoot a gun and hit small objects. Steve Ember and Barbara Klein tell us about Annie Oakley.
There are hundreds of stories about Annie Oakley. Many of the stories involve her adventures in the American Wild West. Others tell about her travels with Native American tribes. However, most of the stories are not true. She did not grow up in the Wild West, nor did she fight in any battles. Annie Oakley was a performer in a traveling Wild West show. She used her skill at shooting a gun to become one of the most famous sharpshooters in American history.
Annie Oakley was born in 1860 in Dark County, Ohio. Her real name was Phoebe Ann Mosey. When she was 6 years old, her father died of pneumonia. Her family was very poor. She did not attend school. When she was 9 years old, Annie went to live with another family on a farm. Then she became a servant for still another family. She later said that this new family abused her. When Annie returned to live with her own family, she decided to help them earn money. She taught herself how to shoot her grandfather's gun and began hunting animals for food. She could shoot the animals without ruining the important parts of the meat. She sold the animals to the people in her town. When she was 15 years old, she had made enough money to pay for her family's farm.
Soon, her ability to shoot a gun became well known in her town. When she was 16 years old, she was invited to a shooting contest with a famous marksman named Frank Butler. Frank Butler claimed that he could shoot better than anyone else. Annie surprised everyone when she won the competition. She shot all 25 targets, while Frank Butler was only able to shoot 24 of them. Perhaps their shooting abilities attracted them to one another, because Annie and Frank married in 1876.
In 1882, Annie took the name Oakley. She and Frank Butler started putting on shows together, demonstrating their abilities to shoot a gun. Frank Butler was the star of the show, and Annie Oakley was his assistant. However, sometimes she did her own shooting. 2 years later, Annie Oakley met the famous Native American chief Sitting Bull at a performance. The chief liked her skill in shooting and also her personality. They became friends. He gave her the name Little Sure Shot because of her shooting ability and because she was only 1.5 meters tall.
In 1885, Annie Oakley and Frank Butler joined another traveling show. It was called Buffalo Bill's Wild West. William Cody, better known as Buffalo Bill, ran the show. For 16 years, Annie Oakley was the star of the show, while Frank Butler was her assistant. Posters for the show called her a champion markswoman. The Wild West show became very famous all over the United States. all of the performers demonstrated their skills. Many of the performers had fought in real gun battles while settling the western part of the United States. They wanted to bring the excitement and mystery of the Wild West to a show that people would like to watch.
Annie Oakley did tricks that showed off how good she was at aiming and shooting a gun. She could shoot a small metal coin thrown in the air from 27 meters away. She could shoot the thin edge of a playing card and then shoot it 6 more times as it fell to the ground. She could shoot the ashes off a cigarette her husband Frank Butler held in his mouth. In 1887, Buffalo Bill took the whole Wild West show to Europe. They traveled to many countries and gave many performances. They performed in England for Queen Victoria. Annie Oakley received a lot of attention. The newspapers wrote stories about her, and she took part in many shooting contests.
The Wild West show returned to Europe 2 years later. By this time, Annie Oakley had become even more famous. The Wild West show performed in Paris, France for 6 months. Then the performers traveled to Germany, Italy, and Spain. In Germany, the Crown Prince asked Oakley to shoot the ashes off of a cigarette that he held in his mouth, as she famously had done with her husband. She asked the prince to hold the cigarette in his hand instead, and did the trick easily.
When the Wild West show returned to the United States, Buffalo Bill decided to change it to include scenes from the life and culture of the Wild West. These scenes included train robberies, gunfights, and conflicts with Native American Indians. In 1901, Annie Oakley was in a train crash that badly injured her back. She had 5 operations. Annie and Frank wanted to stop traveling so much and have their own home. So they left the Wild West show. They built a home in Cambridge, Maryland. They liked this area because it had a nice community and there were many places they could go hunting. Annie Oakley and Frank Butler took part in community activities. Oakley gave shooting lessons and demonstrations at the local county fair.
Annie Oakley wrote a book about her life that was published in 1914. It was called Powders I Have Used. She also tried to get women to learn how to shoot a gun so that they could defend themselves. During World War I, Annie Oakley offered to help the military. She proposed to train a group of women volunteers who would become soldiers in the war. However, the United States did not accept this offer. She also offered to give the American troops shooting lessons. She traveled across the country and visited many training camps. She gave shooting demonstrations and raised money for medicine and supplies.
In 1925, Annie Oakley and Frank Butler moved back to Ohio to be near her family. They continued to give performances, but Annie Oakley was sick. She died on November 3, 1926.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.